On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Cisco's got a brand new bag. We talk about the coming Windows Xpocalypse, and live action, it's got your performance. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt. This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 86, recorded April 7th, 2014. Live action and the Internet of Vulnerable Things. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by TechServe, the world's largest independent Apple retailer and professional services provider. Go to techserve.com/twyatt-7sins to get access to the free ebook on the 7 deadly sins of iPad deployment. And by RingCentral, the cloud-based phone system we use just got better with the launch of Meetings, a full-service video conference feature. Zero startup costs on RingCentral starts at under $25 a month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone and get a second phone free up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. Welcome to Twyatt This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. And of course, I'm joined by my regular all-star cast of characters, starting with Mr. Brian Chi, the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. Brian, did you survive your interop trip? Are you back in one piece?
I am back in one piece. I have lost 10 pounds and 1 inch on my waist, so the interop diet worked as planned.
Isn't the interop diet mostly, consisting of vodka?
No, I like single malt.
Okay. All right. Another man who actually really, really loves his single malt, Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, so good to see you. And you seem to be more illuminated today. You're just glowing. You must be glowing.
Well, Padre, it's the most amazing thing. I go to the desert, and not only do I come back with a vivid tan, but the lighting bunny hopped through the studio and left lights. It's a wonderful thing.
It is a wonderful thing. We love living in the light. Now, gentlemen, let's get right to it because we've got an action-packed show. Later on, we'll be bringing on the CTO of Live Action to tell you how application performance management at Acceleration works. But before that, let's jump into an enterprise bite. We're talking right now about Cisco, specifically about how Cisco seems to be parting ways with EMC. Now, over the last couple of years, you may have noticed that Cisco has slowly been backing away from EMC and its subsidiary, VMware. People noticed that it wasn't being pushed as much. Whenever you tried to buy Cisco gear, yes, it was an offering, but it wasn't the only offering, and it definitely wasn't the offering that they thought you should buy. Well, now we know the reason. 3 days ago, there was a statement from Cisco announcing that they have officially partnered with Red Hat for server hypervisor capabilities. Now, the VP for virtualization at Red Hat, Tim Burke, was quoted as saying, "Red Hat is excited to be collaborating with Cisco to offer our customers an application-centric infrastructure that is integrated with Red Hat Enterprise Linux OpenStack platform." Now, let me de-buzzwordify that thing for you. Basically, what he's saying is, look, we're going to be embedded into a lot of Cisco products because we were willing to bend over backwards for what Cisco wanted out of their virtualization suite. I want to throw this over to you first, Hubert. This collaboration seems focused on three innovations, in OpenStack networking, in Open vSwitch, and in Open Daylight. These are three core Cisco technologies that are now going to be supported by Red Hat. Why do you think Cisco backed away from EMC?
I think a lot of it is because EMC has been, shall we say, slow or hesitant to adopt some of the open networking standards. We all understand, they're not standards yet. They're just strong suggestions, and everybody's trying to tinker with it and see what works. But Red Hat has jumped in with both feet, and they have embraced a lot of these pseudo standards that are slowly starting to become standards. And I think, my personal opinion is because it's based on a Linux kernel, there's a lot more really, really interesting things you can do. I would say we're probably going to see a lot more virtualization, kind of ooze into different Cisco product lines because our friends at Red Hat apparently are a lot more flexible on what they're willing to do than EMC.
Yeah, and that was pretty much my read. Now, Curtis, I want to jump over to you because when you do look at those technologies that Cisco is most readily integrating into their line, again, OpenStack Networking, which allows software to define network configuration and policy, Open vSwitch, which uses Cisco's OpFlex technology, which allows for real-time redeployment of existing hardware switches and controllers, and then Open Daylight, which is sort of a way to encapsulate all of that into a Cisco controller. As Chibert mentioned, these are suggestions. They haven't become standards yet, but what do you see from the enterprise side? Will this be an easier sell for say, a CTO approaching his CFO saying, look, we can offer you a lower-cost solution than buying a huge EMC and array. We can offer a solution that probably already exists in our data center since we're most likely using something from Red Hat. And we can offer you a solution that uses the existing Cisco gear that we've probably already installed.
Well, here's my take on this. I don't think this has anything to do with sales today. I think that this is Oracle positioning itself and Cisco positioning itself not for today, but for the virtualization wars that are to come. What we're seeing, and we heard a lot of talk about this at Interop, is companies that are declaring their willingness to use the open standards, but looking at the cracks in the standards, looking at the extensible space around the standards, and positioning themselves to be, if you will, a pseudo standard around the big standard. So whose implementation of OpenStack is going to be the one that most companies want to interact with? Because as we well know, interoperability is not a foregone conclusion right now. I think this has a lot to do with Cisco wanting to be there and be part of that standard beyond the standard, if you will. So I'm looking 2 years out rather than what they can sell this year.
Right. And that actually makes sense because, again, even though we've played with network gear from a lot of vendors and there's some really good gear out there, we still know that Cisco owns the vast lion's share of all enterprise class gear that's sold around the world. And so if Cisco builds something into their switches, into their controllers, and if that happens to be Red Hat, and if they happen to have a great partnership with Red Hat, that lets Cisco take a much bigger chunk of the profits than they could with EMC, then, I mean, doesn't that become the de facto standard? I mean, let me throw that back to you, Curtis. I mean, if you now have the option of saying, I'm going to go buy something from EMC, they've got some great virtualization software with VMware, or I could use something that's already in my switches and controllers, which one do you use?
Well, I think that obviously they want to continue to use what's in their switches and routers now. And again, this is one of those cases where Cisco has been the de facto standard for a long time. I mean, we've all heard even their control language. Everyone knows that lots and lots of companies rip off Cisco's iOS and refer, they file off just enough of the identifying stuff to keep it legal. And IP lawyers know precisely what that percentage is. So they file it off and it becomes an not industry standard, but industry familiar programming and configuration language. Well, Cisco wants to remain the de facto standard in the industry. And I think that they have seen the advent of software-defined networking and virtualization of networking as one of those inflection points where a competitor could come in. And so this is a strongly defensive move designed to keep Cisco right there in the middle of all those enterprise data centers by using an accepted piece of open source software that, oh, by the way, happens to work beautifully with what they've already got going on in the gear that's sitting on the floor.
Got it. Now, Chibert, back to you. The chat room's kind of going crazy. They love the fact that we're jammering around virtualization right now. But let me ask you, have you played with Red Hat's KVM virtualization suite?
Yeah, actually, the mirror site that I host is based on KVM, and it is fast. It's not as, shall we say, out of the box easy to set up as, say, Microsoft Hyper-V, especially since the Hyper-V, the one without a GUI, is now basically free. So I am not actually sure KVM is even cheaper. But what I am sure is KVM has a lot of open source foundation, which means it can be moved around, it can be changed, it can be modified, and it can be OEM'd a lot easier. Because our friends at Microsoft and VMware, even though they kind of rule this market segment, they are not as always open at special customization. And they're also certainly not as open on giving really, really deep pocket discounts that Cisco seems to want.
Got it. And that actually makes a lot of sense. I mean, when you look at it, when you ask the question, well, why Red Hat? Why wouldn't they just say, take the free hypervisor from Microsoft or continue working with EMC? I guess ultimately what it comes down to is Cisco is looking at the future, as Curtis said, and they're saying, we want to be able to differentiate our products. We want to be able to control our offerings. We want to have minute capabilities to change things according to the hardware that we plan to release. I think they get that with Red Hat. Last question to Curtis. When we look at Cisco and we look at EMC, Cisco is really good with servers. They're really good with switches. They're really good with anything that has to do with backbone networking, UCS, even storage arrays. Their new Invicta storage flash arrays are absolutely fantastic. EMC is known for storage. They're known for storage management, and they're known for VMware, which gives them virtualization. Since Cisco is going to be able to get pretty much everything out of Red Hat that they used to get out of EMC, what does this do for EMC? I mean, if you were sitting with a big chunk of EMC stock right now, are you not worried? Do you think EMC is just going to be just fine? This is just another customer that has gone another route? Or does this cut off a major source of income?
I suspect it's more the former than the latter. I suspect that this is just one of EMC's many customers, a non-trivial one, but just one customer. And frankly, it wouldn't surprise me at all if EMC isn't already talking to some other large partners trying to come out with a story that says, hey, we're not partnering with Cisco anymore, but we're partnering with someone else who has some other key feature. Look for EMC to partner with a network infrastructure company that is focused on performance, raw screaming speed, or that has been one of the early companies to come out with fully featured virtualized switches. They're going to look for an advantage. EMC will be the big partner in that relationship. So I think there are some interesting things coming, but we're still, to be brutally honest, somewhere between 2 and 4 years from this market starting to settle out in a significant way at all.
Wonderful. Stay tuned, because I'm sure that this story is going to develop. I'm sure we're going to see something from EMC. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw a big partnership announcement coming up. But before we bid that story farewell, I want to sort of take it and tuck it underneath, because we've got something else that really does pertain to enterprise technology, something that Chibert submitted to the doc, and that is, well, maybe you need a gig broadband, but maybe you don't need it over fiber. Now, we all want speed. We all want fiber, and we all want it now. But there's a company in North Carolina that is working on delivering gig broadband without the fiber, without the wires, without the muss and the fuss. We're talking about a startup called RST, which built and acquired 3,100 miles of 100 gig fiber infrastructure, mostly to the state of North Carolina and parts of South Carolina. Now, the interesting thing is not that they've acquired all that fiber, although that is a massive accomplishment when you consider how difficult it is to get some sort of contiguous network. But the big story is that they want to use 802.11ac, a wireless standard in Wi-Fi, to deliver that last mile. So rather than running the fiber to each and every single house, they're just going to use wireless technologies, one that is commonly available on the marketplace today, to give you that last mile of connectivity. Now, Chibert, sounds interesting. My question is going to be this. It might work in rural areas of North and South Carolina. It might work where there's not a whole lot of population. It might work where you can get tall towers so that you can get direct line of sight to each of your clients. But does this survive scalability? I mean, ultimately, we're going to run up into the physics of wireless spectrum, right?
Yes and no. What they're trying to pull actually works even better in metro areas, because then you can start using the metal and glass of buildings to help shape your Wi-Fi parameter, you know, Wi-Fi signals. Wi-Fi is not the same as it we all got used to. Most of the enterprise-grade Wi-Fi is no longer using those stupid rubber ducky antennas that go out in all directions. They're using sectorized panels, just like you might see on a cell tower. They're just tuned for a different frequency. And because you can shape it and also start getting into things like what Xeris and Ruckus have done with steerable beam technology by using two antenna elements and using that to steer the beam, it starts getting to be a lot more efficient to do lots and lots of small cells. Now, a lot of these smaller, you know, this has been tried many, many times all over the United States, all over the world, but it hasn't worked because they don't have enough backhaul. So that's what this is really starting to be, you know, have some serious potential, because having that back-end backhaul means you can afford to start doing smaller cells. When you do smaller cells, you can start doing higher speeds because you don't have people running with really, really weak signals, which is actually almost exactly what we did at Interop by doing lots and lots of APs so we can load balance and shift people over to a stronger signal.
Curtis, let me throw this over to you, and I want to pick up on something that Chiebert started to talk about, which is, this is not a new idea. This has been done. We've talked about mesh networking. We've talked about point-to-point wireless. We've talked about building out existing backhauls into a wireless infrastructure. And the effort always seems to peter out. Why is that? Is it just not enough money, not enough political influence? Or do you think there's something fundamentally wrong with trying to deliver the last mile wirelessly?
Well, delivering the last mile wirelessly, you've got both technical problems and political and then financial problems. Technologically, we've been talking here about, and you brought up the idea of density, the fact that as more people come online using this, the speeds go down. This is the same problem that just about everyone has when it comes to high-speed networking of any sort. Politically, they are frequently going up against entrenched incumbents. So if they have to fight the cable company for last mile, if they have to fight a decent and established telco for last mile, it makes it much, much harder. And finally, there's the financial. The basic fact is that you need a certain density of customer to make it worthwhile. There's an extent to which it's the same problem that public transportation has. Unless you have population density, you just don't have the economic critical mass to make it all worthwhile. Now, I suspect that what's going on in North Carolina is that you're going to see a mix of customers. North Carolina is a state with a handful of decent-sized cities and an awful lot of smaller towns that are truly strung out. Towns that may well not have strong entrenched incumbents when it comes to high-speed networking of any sort. There, the state can look at subsidizing the high-speed networking in order to attract business to these smaller locations. They can look at subsidizing it for schools and other educational institutions, and those communities that want it can put together some sort of monopoly-type deal to encourage everyone to use this service for their high-speed networking in lieu of going to a cable company or telco. I suspect that what they're seeing is a unique situation in a particular state. We're going to have to be watching it there, and whether or not it will transfer to any other state is a very good question. I've got my doubts when it comes to many of the other 50 states.
Chiebert, Curtis said something very interesting there when he was talking about the critical mass needed to make it economically possible to do some sort of deployment like this. It seems to me like this is chasing the dragon's tail here, where you need a certain population density in order to make this economically feasible. But the technology itself, even though AC is far more advanced, far better at previous standards, at being able to timeshare between multiple clients, as you make it more economically viable, you're also going to make it more technologically difficult. And at some point, you are going to run into physics, right? I mean, you can't go past a certain density, no matter how small you make your cell size, before you start getting just horrible, horrible throughput.
That's true. But keep in mind, AC uses the 5.8 gigahertz uniband, which has lots more channels. And keep in mind, just because you have another device on the same channel doesn't mean it's going to trash your connection. It just means that you're time slicing. So that means if you can time slice, you know, 30 or 40 channels and then time slice maybe 10 or 15 per channel, that's still an awful lot of bandwidth per area. Now, one of the nice things about their approach that I think I would like to applaud is that they are not using licensed bandwidth, which means it's a lower cost of entry. And from what I understand, North Carolina, the areas they're going, they're actually starting to service areas that are not well serviced to begin with. So they're probably going to be able to get a lot of these special tax credits on providing connectivity into rural areas. An entire community on the Big Island of Hawaii was set up, including poles and fiber and everything, just from federal subsidies in the same area as Lifeline service for telco. So they're probably using a lot of federal incentives to provide connectivity. And because they're in a non-licensed bandwidth, they can get in faster and easier with just renting roof space.
Well, gentlemen, thank you very much. That's the end of the Enterprise Bite. When we come back, we're going to be speaking with the CTO of Live Action, John Smith, all about action performance. And later on, we've got a new segment for the Twiat Riot, Exploit. We're going to be talking all about the things that keep us up at night. But before we get to all that goodness, I thought now might be a good chance to stop, pause, and thank one of our sponsors, one of the people, one of the companies that makes this show possible. And of course, that's TechServe. Now, we are seeing some amazing technologies being deployed on iPads these days. Businesses keep coming up with new ways to service their customers, to increase productivity among employees, and to make more money with the same resources, all by using the iPad. For example, the Institute of Culinary Education equips students, faculty, and chefs with the iPad, empowering them to do away with heavy and unwieldy textbooks and streamline the learning process. A major cable service provider in the Northeast gave its field technicians, who are the public face of the company, iPads that had been configured to provide better service to customers. And retail companies have enhanced their in-store customer experience by using the iPad, not just as a point-of-sale device, but also as a spot where customers can learn about sales, special offers, and upcoming events. Now, these clients and more have turned to TechServe, the country's largest Apple reseller that sells, supports, and manages the largest iPad deployments in the world, to manage their projects. If you're considering adding iPads to your business, why not ensure the project's success with an experienced partner, with someone who knows the business? TechServe assists businesses of all sizes to deploy Apple solutions, as well as solutions from Avid, Adobe, and much more, throughout the United States. No matter if you've started deploying iPads already or are just getting started, TechServe has the knowledge to help. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to try TechServe. We want to see if maybe they are the ones who will help you with your iPad deployment. Right now, TechServe is offering a complimentary download just for my listeners who are deploying iPads or who are interested in learning more about doing so. Go to TechServe.com/Twiat-7Sins to get access to the 7 deadly sins of iPad deployment and see the common pitfalls that throw companies for a loop during their iPad projects. This complimentary download is available right now just for Twiat listeners at TechServe.com/Twiat-7Sins. And we thank TechServe for their support of this week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get to it. Welcome to the show, John Smith, the CTO of Live Action. John, thank you very much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Now, before we get any further, can you explain really quickly, what is Live Action? What do you do? What did you create the company to do?
Well, a lot of our customers have problems, you know, understanding the network. The network is producing much more information. So the first thing that our product does is visualize that. And you know, like you were talking about all the Cisco products, you know, they're building a lot of capabilities. So we go really in-depth understanding Cisco technologies, enabling it, and also controlling it as well.
Okay. Can you give me an example of that? Because we've heard that, I mean, I'm not being disrespectful here, but we've heard that sales pitch before. We hear it every single time we go to Interop, every time I go to one of these conferences. They all say, well, our tool will allow you to do X, X, Y, and then suddenly you will be billionaires. What is it about your approach? What is it that you saw not happening in the industry that you thought we're going to do that?
Yeah, so the visualization piece is really, really different. And, you know, we started off doing military contracts and we had to help like staff sergeant, 20-year-olds, you know, really be able to understand the network. And we did research on, you know, what's the best way to show the network so that they can, you know, quickly identify and fix problems. So we came up with this unique visualization. You got to really see it. And we'll be at Cisco Live and, you know, please come down to the booth and see it. But, you know, I showed a staff sergeant, gave him 30 minutes of training and came back the next day and he's yelling at people because he understood what exactly was going on, what his corporals were doing to his network, and he was, you know, really orchestrating it. So definitely the way we visualize it is completely unique to, you know, what people have done in the past.
Well, what have you seen done in the past? I mean, when you look back and you examine tools that you thought were not enough, they just didn't give you enough information, they didn't give it easy enough, they didn't give it quick enough, what were the things that you think management tools, application tools need to avoid?
So at the end of the day, you typically see things like, you know, bar charts, time series graphs, but you know, it's not really how the network engineers think. So if you go to like a conference or tutorial or training, typically, they visually show you the network in a topology view, and that's how people debug. That's how they understand their network. So at the end of the day, your network management tool should provide real-time information mapped to that topology view, allow you to explore it. And there's a principle behind this. It's called Ensley's Situational Awareness Model. And if you follow that, it allows people to really understand, really comprehend, and debug things a lot quicker.
Got it. Okay, so let me ask a quick question that an IT person might come up to you with. So let's say you're at Cisco Live and I'm an IT guy and I say, look, I've got a lot of different types of gear. I've got gear from Cisco. I've got gear from HP. I've got different types of solutions and they've all sort of been mashed together. They work for me, but I've got 9 different control panels. I've got 9 different status screens. I've got a dozen different places where I need to go to check logs and to check status.
Right.
What would Live Action do for that?
So Live Action, you know, concentrates on SNMP and NetFlow, so multi-vendor NetFlow. And we see the industry and customers adopting a lot of NetFlow, IPFix, SFlow. So we kind of concentrated on, you know, being the best product at grabbing all that information. And we kind of realized, you know, at the lowest level, there's you know, packet capture. And the level above that is NetFlow. But NetFlow is in a condensed format that allows you to get quicker understanding of the overall situation. But they're exporting so much detail, almost like, you know, application level information. It actually is. And it helps you to debug, you know, applications going through the network much easier.
Right. We've got a question from EGF Tech Man in our chat room. We've got a chat room that's they're live and they're filled with brilliant people. But he would like to know in his scenario, well, what would Live Action do for, say, a network that has a couple of dozens or maybe even hundreds of 802.1Q VLANs?
Right. So we have a visualization that shows you at the LAN level. So we actually parse the virtual trunking paths. We'll show you port channels, ether channels. We'll show you spanning tree in real time. So we have a video on YouTube that shows you debugging spanning tree, you know, using the command line versus our tool, and it's like night and day difference.
Right. Okay, now let's bust this down a little bit. We've got some of your Live Action videos, your demonstrations up on the board. What are we seeing here? I mean, you're talking about control. You're talking about the ability to manage a network, but you know what? What exactly are you trying to sell us? I mean, I understand you're using NetFlows, you're using logs, but how do you generate this sort of map of information?
Yeah, so we actually discover the network automatically, and then we bring that information to build out this topology. And this topology is really detailed, all the way down to your port channel, ether channels, GREs. So it's like a living visual diagram of your network. But on top of that, we're projecting NetFlow. So whether it's, you know, application information in NetFlow or security, we project it. You can see exactly how it's going across your network. But, you know, as customers or your clients, you know, call in for the problems, you can, you have a little search bar. And you can just say, you know, IP address this with DSCP here coming from this site. And we'll automatically show you end-to-end that flow path. Makes it a lot easier to debug.
We got Max1234 in the chat room saying, does this handle Cisco ASA?
Yes, it does. It'll actually do NCell templates coming off of the ASA.
Yeah. Now, once you've got this topology, one of the things that I hear a lot is that you do performance application performance management. How does that work?
So I was talking at the first part about the visualization piece, but the second part of this product is, you know, we work really closely with Cisco and working in understanding all the different latest technologies. Examples are like IWAN, PFR, AVC. And what we do is we can actually deploy all that technology without cracking open that Cisco manual. We'll put those command lines in for you automatically, get all the information, analyze it. And at the end of the day, we actually can configure things like quality of service, policy-based routing, ACLs to help fix those issues.
Let's talk a little bit about that. Let's talk about quality of service, because one of the things that has been brought up recently is as we move towards this quote-unquote Internet of Things, quality of service is going to become more important, especially as we move things into the cloud. We need a way to be able to measure our performance, our application performance. Why is that important, and how? What's your angle in it? How do you approach that?
Yeah, with the Internet of Things and really just BYOD in general, everybody's doing, you know, video, voice, whether it's, you know, Twitter, Vine, YouTube, Hulu. It's really inundating all our customers. And it's only going to get worse. And the Internet of Things with all the sensors on your body, in your toaster at home, it's going to just, you know, suck up all the bandwidth. And, you know, with TCP and UDP traffic, it's going to try to suck up as much of the bandwidth. So just buying more bandwidth is not really a solution. You really do need to prioritize all these different types of traffic. And that's where quality of service comes in, is allowing you to mark this traffic, give it preferential treatment, and then make decisions on, you know, which ones you get, you know, better performance. So for example, voice and video needs to go through like a low latency queue, for example, being able to set that up, doing, you know, random early detect to drop TCP traffic to throttle back automatically. So those are the type of capabilities that are actually built into QoS.
Now, Cheever, I understand you had a QoS demo not too long ago. I know that people love tweaking their network, but eventually we end up with just throw more bandwidth at it, right? How is this approach different?
Well, the whole idea is, you know, you can actually have very large spikes, especially if someone, say you get a person doing a large download or something. Throwing more bandwidth at it is just a band-aid, really and truly. So, for instance, the demo that John and his band of merry men did for me a long time ago, actually had a set of VoIP phones set up, and we were actually running it back and forth so that we could hear the Muzak in the background, so to speak. And then what we did was we ramped up some background traffic. In this case, it was just file transfers and things like that. And very, very quickly, even though we were running at gig speeds, the voice channels just started going to hell very, very quickly. And then what the guys did was literally just kick off a script to go and apply a QoS profile across the router network. And instantly, the voice got way, way, way better. So keep in mind, everybody calls it quality of service, but it's really not. It's class of service. All you're doing is saying which set of packets, according to the labels, go first. Quality of service is actually kind of a hangover from the days of ATM, where you actually carved off little bits and pieces of the pipe dedicated only to a single application or a single path. That's not what we're doing today in modern Ethernet. It's all class of service. So think about it as who gets off first.
Jason, I think if you go to the live action page, you can use the fixed video. We can see exactly how those policies get applied. But John, I want to jump back to you really quickly because we do have some people in the chat room who are saying, hey, look, can't you just use the tool just to block the hog? Whoever's killing your bandwidth, who's ever hurting your application performance, you just kick them off the network or throttle them. What are the actions that would be allowed by your suite? So let's say I'm using your solution on my network. I'm already impressed by the fact that it can apply quality of service rules or class of service rules across all my gear to protect a particular application. But what typically would I have in my arsenal? If I am that IT guy and I start seeing issues on my network, what can I do with live action to resolve the video conference that can't go down or the file sync that needs to happen at full speed?
Right. So there's probably two key approaches. Like first is if you know the offender, you could right click on that flow visually in real time and say, you know, block this with an ACL. And we'll handle all the CLI commands for you automatically. The second is you could go into the QoS policy and just, you know, get more bandwidth or provide better preferential treatment to that video. And you do that through our easy-to-use GUI as well. So I think those are the two fastest ways.
Yeah, I think we're watching it happen right now. So what we have is we have the administrator who's identified a problem. He's identified an issue that's happening on his network. And so what's he doing? He's identifying the equipment that's causing it. He's identifying the class of service that needs to be established to protect the performance of the application he needs to protect. What else is going on?
Yeah, so we're actually figuring out, you know, exactly how much bandwidth to provide that application. We'll actually figure out the exact CLI. And we're not just pushing templates out here. We actually know the configuration that's on the router. So we know what set of commands have to be, you know, removed and what needs to be added. So it's not like a CMDB that just pushes out policy blindly. We can push it out to specific devices with existing policies. So that's a big key differentiator for us.
Got it. All right. Well, John, let's say that someone is now looking at this demonstration and they're saying, all right, this is interesting. Where can they find you? If they wanted to come to a booth or talk to some of your engineers and actually see this in action, what questions should they be asking? Who should they be talking to?
Well, we'll be at Cisco Live in May, so please stop by our booth. You could go to our website, liveaction.com, and you know, just it's a free download. Try it out. If you have questions or if you want some training or other WebEx, we're happy to do that. And we actually have like a monthly WebEx on different topics. So we had one on like DMVPN and we did one on Microsoft Lync. So you know, check out our YouTube channel as well because we have a lot of video up there.
Fantastic. John, I also promise that we'll have you back on the show at some point when I'm back in studio and hopefully when you're in California. We actually want to show our audience how this works in real time. Videos are good. Demonstrations are okay. But I know the Twiat Riot and they demand excellence. It looks like a great solution and Cheebert vouches for you. So I definitely want to have you in studio to just run me through how this is going to be the solution for my software-defined networking.
Yeah, definitely. Be happy to.
Yeah. Now, do you want to say something to? I'll give you 60 seconds here. What do you want to tell people about live action? What do you want to tell people about you? What do you want to tell people who maybe might be looking at your solution right now?
Yeah. So you know, our customer base is a lot related to Cisco. So if you're doing anything related to like Cisco QoS, PFR, IWAN, AVC. You know, we're the main tool for that. We're actually on the price list with Cisco and we work with the resellers very closely. So if, you know, instead of cracking open that Cisco manual, come look at our tool because I think we'll really be able to help you. And if you're multi-vendor and doing a lot of visualization of your network and trying to really understand that, you know, if you're trying to deploy NetFlow, I think we're the tool for you for sure.
I love it. John Smith, the CTO of Live Action. Thank you so very much for being a guest and we'll have you again.
Okay, thank you.
Take care. Now, when we come back, we're going to be trying out a brand new segment, Exploit. We want to talk about the things that keep us at night. That's Brian Curtis and myself. When we get together and we have a nice quiet night sipping single malt or soda for me, these are the things that will get us all a jitter. But before we get there, I'd like to take another moment to thank another sponsor of the Twiat Riot. And of course, That's Rig Central. You know them, you love them. If you've watched TWiT at all, you know what they do, but I think it bears repeating. Because when we built the studio, when Leo decided that we were going to move out of the cottage into a brand new space, we decided that we wanted a dog food. I mean, we wanted to do the things that we had been telling people to do. Move into the cloud was our message, and we thought it would be hypocritical if we didn't do it ourselves. And when our IT guy, Russell, came to us and told us that we could have a phone system that was in the cloud, that was going to be without a big bunch of cables and boxes in the basement, well, it was a no-brainer. We love RingCentral. Zero startup costs, no PBX hardware to install or maintain. And now RingCentral has launched Meetings. So in addition to all that we love about RingCentral, receiving voicemails through email, sending and receiving fax messages from our smartphones, the auto receptionist who greets our callers and announces employees and department extensions, now with Meetings, we can host face-to-face meetings in high definition and share desktop or documents with anyone, anytime, anywhere, on any device. Meetings makes RingCentral the single best business solution on the market today. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to succeed. We want you to prosper. We want you to have the same sort of tech nirvana that we found with RingCentral. RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing under $25 a month per user. You can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial, and they have a special offer for my listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. So call this number designated for my listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. One more time, just for the class of service, 800-543-9980. Or you can go to ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. That's ringcentral.com, promo code TWIT. And we thank RingCentral for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now let's get off to the exploit. Now, when we were thinking about this segment, we figured that we wanted to look at some persistent threats, some things that had been moving through the enterprise, some things that had been keeping up network administrators, and we came up with a list of the things that we wanted to keep our eyes on. Very first on the list was the coming Xpocalypse. That's right, the end of life for XP, which means the end of life for a lot of the enterprise as we know it. Now, we know that the end of life comes tomorrow. Microsoft will halt all updates for Windows XP starting at around noon. They will continue virus warnings until April 14th, 2015, but users will be on their own. Now, Tim Raines, the director of Microsoft's Trustworthy Computing Group, was quoted as saying, the very first month that Microsoft releases security updates for all the supported versions of Windows, which means not XP, they will reverse engineer those updates, find the vulnerabilities, and test Windows XP to see if XP might share those updated vulnerabilities. Now, as expected, we saw a decrease in the number of zero-day exploits used on XP in the last 3 months. But that doesn't mean that there are no zero-day exploits out there. It just means that, they're saving them up. I mean, if you're a black hat or even a gray hat hacker out there, you're not going to release exploits into the wild if you know that Microsoft might still patch them. If you save them up, starting tomorrow, you can use them forever. That's right. There will never be a patch. There will never be a way to protect that machine. There will never be a way for someone to be secure against your brand spanking new exploit. Now, Chibert, I want to throw this over to you first. We've been talking about this. Everyone's been talking about this. It's been all over the TWiT TV network. We have it on This Week in Tech. We had it on Security Now. We had it on Windows Weekly. We had it on TWiT. We even had it on Know How. But yet, we still have all these enterprises who are panicking at the last minute, thinking, oh my God, the sky is falling.
Buy them books. Send them to school. What do you do? Yeah, XP is probably Microsoft's most successful operating system since MS-DOS. And keep in mind, MS-DOS or variations of DOS are still being used in a lot of the embedded industry. I am actually saying he who is still running XP in a general purpose computer, I'm sorry, you get whatever you get. You've had more than enough warning. Now, the people that are doing embedded systems, now that is an entirely different kettle of fish. Embedded systems are purposely harder to upgrade because they are technically hardened already. So we're talking about gas pumps. We're talking about ATMs. We're also talking about things like harvesters, you know, the big grain harvesters. They're still running XP. Heck, some of the elevators are still running XP. So there's XP isn't a it shouldn't be a problem for the general purpose computer, but it is a huge, huge problem for the embedded world. Now, keep in mind, a lot of the embedded systems aren't connected to the general internet. Now, they're not on the public internet. So they are a little safer, but this whole thing is a real, still a big problem. Now, RetroDeep did mention that XP embedded, he's talking about Windows CE. No, Windows CE is dramatically different from embedded XP. Embedded XP comes in 16-bit, 32-bit, and so forth, even 64-bit versions. CE is designed more for things like PDAs, ARM-based machines, and so forth. There are embedded versions of both. And, oh, by the way, there's even embedded versions of Microsoft SQL. So, yeah, we're going to have some problems, but I'm not going to say the sky is falling because a lot of the XP numbers are in embedded machines.
Right, right. And Tubert, we also know, to be fair, that many of those machines do use XP embedded, which will maintain support until 2016. I actually kind of like this because it's sort of a trial for those people who should be freaking about their Windows XP embedded machines. If they see the difficulty that we're seeing around the world with XP, standard XP, maybe it will light a fire up their butt to use these last 2 years to figure out a real world and an actually doable redeployment strategy for getting rid of XP embedded. Now, I want to throw over to you, Curtis, because we've got a specific example of this panic. You may remember back in January, we talked about Her Majesty's Service, specifically Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs Department and the National Health Service, both in the UK. We talked about how they had XP running on almost 90,000 machines running between them, that they had a deployment plan, but they were admitting that they were probably going to come up short. Well, now it looks as if the UK government has finally thrown in the towel and they've acknowledged, yeah, there's no way we're going to meet this deadline. They have contracted with Microsoft to provide continuing support for an additional year for all those machines across all the ministries in the United Kingdom for about $9 million. That's about £5.548 million. This is interesting for a few reasons. One, this is the first developed government that has approached Microsoft to say, yeah, we need help. But it's also the first time that there's this huge bulk pricing. It's way, way below what Microsoft's quoted price of $200 per computer per year, rising up to $400 and $800 each successive year for continued XP support. My question to you, Curtis, if I run an enterprise, if I run that mythical 10,000-seat enterprise, and if I'm looking at what's happening over in the UK right now, and most likely what's going to be happening in other government agencies as they realize they're still using XP, would you be tempted? Do you think executives would be tempted to say, $9 million, that's not a whole lot of money when you consider how much it would cost to upgrade all of our systems to a more stable, more protected OS?
Well, I think you might well be tempted, but unless you have your very own Department of Inland Revenue to hold over Microsoft's head as a bargaining chip, I don't think you're going to get anything like the sort of deal that the government of the UK and let's also say the government of the Netherlands has cut with Microsoft. I suspect we're going to see more governments doing this before this is all over. In terms of the companies, I don't think we're going to see that many because, to be brutally honest, the very large organizations, the huge enterprises, have made the shift. They knew it was coming. They've made the shift. And there are other reasons behind besides just going ahead and being on the latest version that caused them to do that. The place where this is really going to hurt a lot are those much smaller companies that have perhaps not embedded systems, but have some sort of industry-specific application, whether it's in something like inventory control or accounting for a specific vertical market or, you know, something that interfaces with another set of suppliers or customers, and you've got 100 or 300 seats doing this. Those are the people who are just going to be in a world of hurt, especially if the company that provided the software in the first place has now gone out of business and you've been running along on a wing and a prayer for the past 5 years. Now, all of a sudden, all of the feathers are falling off that wing. And you're faced with making a huge for you investment very quickly, causing enormous business disruptions. And there's going to be some real pain in those companies. Those are the ones I feel for. The governments, the large enterprises, if they haven't done it yet, they deserve what's coming to them. The smaller companies, those are the ones that are going to have some real honest-to-goodness pain. And it wouldn't, frankly, surprise me to see some of those companies actually go out of business because of either the cost of making the switch or the consequences in security and functionality of not being able to afford to make that switch.
Achievert, I tend to agree with Curtis. I think most major corporations have done this just because they realize the financial incentive of being secure. They understand how horrible it can be if you have a breach because you're using an outdated operating system. And I also agree with him that we're going to probably see a lot more pain on the part of the small business owners. I mean, the most recent survey back in December of 2013 has Windows XP market share still at 28.98%, which is just below that of Windows 7. So taking that into account, and I know you have a unique view here because you see the same issues with Windows XP and, say, versions of Linux that have been forked and then abandoned. Do you think, as some people in the chat room, most notably Retro D, are saying, that Windows XP is ransomware? Is this just a way to sock the little guy for more money?
You know, I don't like calling it ransomware only because, you know, Microsoft is trying to make it bigger, you know, better. You know, everybody wants new features. I don't know of anyone that liked the original plug and play implementation that Microsoft had in Windows XP that cannot be just patched. You know, there's a lot of architecture pieces that have to change. I actually think Java had a really good point that I think those numbers are a little off because there's an awful lot of devices that use XP as, you know, maybe it's not necessarily completely embedded, but I'll bet you a lot of those licenses are in systems that must go with a special system. Like, for instance, I actually had to recover a physical therapy machine at the University of Hawaii Athletic Department that they couldn't afford to upgrade, but that's still based on Windows XP, and it's a very old version of Windows XP. Java had a large format printer with the same thing. Are you going to go and throw away a $15,000, $20,000 large format printer just because it's running XP? I don't think so. Maybe you might want to put it into a different firewall zone, but I don't think you're going to throw it away, and I don't think XP is going to disappear really, really fast. But I think it should disappear on the general purpose machines.
Okay, guys, we're running out of time, and I think we're gonna be able to cover a lot of this discussion in the second segment of the exploit. But Curtis, I want to throw this over to you. Do you think this could become a viable business? What if some enterprising people were to say, hey, look, there's a lot of people out there with applications running on XP, which won't run on 7 or 8. We're going to start a firm that will provide the updates. We're going to start a firm that will actually create the patches that will do the things necessary to keep your XP systems up and running and healthy.
I don't know that there is a large company out there that would be viably able to do this on a nationwide basis. But I tell you what there is an opportunity for an awful lot of 2 to 6 person organizations in smaller towns spread across the country, spread across the world for that matter. They can go in, make a relationship with these companies that cannot move off XP and say, you know what, come what may, we will keep those systems running. We will do whatever custom patching has to be done. We will put some stuff in front of them to help keep them as secure as possible. When things do go wrong, we'll make sure that you're backed up. The care and feeding of these systems is a viable business. And for a lot of people who are in very small cities and towns across the world, this is going to be the thing that lets them form their own small business. That kind of thing I see going on for years and years to come, in the same way that you still have people who are able to make a nice small-scale living repairing treadle-operated manual sewing machines. XP is in that same category now.
Microsoft, creating jobs, one exploit at a time. Now let's move on to the second segment inside of exploit. It's actually something that we've been following for quite a while. Again, that is the vulnerability in SCADA. You remember SCADA? Yeah, the supervisory control and data acquisition devices. These are the little devices that control everything from pumps at plants and water treatment centers to traffic lights to nuclear power plants. I mean, they're pretty much in everything. And remember that SCADA really predates many technologies, including the internet. So it's no surprise that we're finding more and more of these devices hooked up to the internet getting owned. But there was just a release of a new research report that I think actually has me chilled. Specifically, it found that devices using the Centum CS3000 software, it's a specific SCADA module, could be exploited to give total remote access. In other words, the access that someone would have sitting in front of one of these consoles at over 7,600 installations. Now, these installations include oil rigs, refineries, power plants, and other industrial sites. Now, let's not get FUD here. We don't like doing that. We're not saying, yeah, the sky is falling. Yeah, things are going to blow up. Oil plants are going to start falling into the sea, whatever it is. But what we are saying is that the devices that are on those rigs, in those factories, wherever these industrial applications may be, are incredibly easy to breach. In fact, the Department of Homeland Security, that's the ICS CERT, the Industrial Control Systems Cyber Emergency Response Team, thanks, Department of Homeland Security, a branch of that Department of Homeland Security, they said that the exploits could be used by someone with quote-unquote low skill. In other words, it's only a matter of time before this gets packaged into a script kiddie tool and people just point and click and infect. Chibrit, let me throw this over to you first. We've talked about SCADA in the very recent past, that it is a growing problem. And now that we know that some of these systems, which are running these huge industrial applications, can be very easily compromised, what's your take? I mean, is it now time to really get worried, or is this still, it's interesting, but not really going to happen in the real world?
Actually, I'm going to answer that a little bit by going into back in history. Keep in mind, SCADA was designed by mechanical engineers and electrical engineers to solve a problem of how to provide for remote control of devices, things like valves and temperature sensors and pressure sensors and things like that. There was absolutely no thought about putting security in because nobody was going to use it except the engineers. Well, here's the problem. As a result, they're also very sensitive. There are quite a few SCADA-type devices that still have that old attitude. Oh, nobody's going to break into me because I'm so isolated. You know, I'm at the Arctic Circle or I'm in Alaska on an oil rig. Well, the problem is if you can get access to the system, then you can basically have the keys to the kingdom. My spin on this is, I'm sorry, Mr. Mechanical Engineer, the world does not revolve around you anymore. You're going to have to start actually working with and playing nice with some real computer scientists that are going to help you redesign the SCADA stack on your devices. You know, the very fact of the matter is some SCADA devices are so badly designed, all I have to do is send 10 pings in a row and I'll flatten the device. This right. type of, you know, head in the sand attitude has to stop.
Yeah. Now, we've got Max1234 in the chat room who's asking, well, why couldn't we just VM SCADA? You can't. SCADA devices are tied to whatever industrial equipment that they're tied to. You can't just suddenly say, well, we'll VM it. We'll make it network connectable to the device. That's not how they're designed. You got to remember, especially with SCADA devices that we're talking about now, or the ones that say back in January, that Russian researcher owned, he owned about 60,000 compromised systems. These devices were not designed to be network connected. The network connectivity came later on when people said, oh, wouldn't it be nice if we could control these from another location? So again, you know, VM's great, but you can't just throw VM at everything and say, yeah, that's going to fix it. Curtis, I want to throw this over to you. So the vulnerabilities that they listed are threefold. First, that malforwarded packets sent to port 2171 can trigger a stack-based overflow. Sending malformed packets to TCP port 2111 can also trigger a stack-based overflow. And sending a sequence of malformed packets to UDP port 52302 triggers a heap-based overflow, which allows you to essentially use the controller to DDoS the back-end server. Now, with these vulnerabilities, one of the prevalent thoughts has been, well, just disconnect them. Now, Cheever talked about this, right? Just get those systems off the internet, get them off the network, isolate them, get them behind a firewall, get them behind a corridor that just no one else has access to, which in the old world would have worked. But with the rise of advanced persistent threats, which can jump across air gaps, that's not really an option anymore, right? I mean, do execs understand that? Do they understand that simply disconnecting from the internet is no longer a rock-solid defense?
No, to be brutally honest. The vast majority of executives would say exactly what the folks are saying. You know, disconnected from the internet. That would be the first command to go out. Well, we've got a vulnerability. Pull the plug, disconnect them from the internet, and now we're safe. Well, not only are they not safe, but in a lot of situations, they can no longer continue to use the processes and procedures that have been put in place over the last decade. It's a double whammy. In some cases, if you are, let's say, someone eager to cause mischief, it's the perfect scenario. You've just disrupted business without doing a darn thing. I mean, the effort level on your part is zero. The disruption has happened. Once again, I've got to say, this is a situation that I'm not so much worried about, say, a Monsanto or a Cargill, somebody who's that size and sophistication. They may have a few stray things out in the field that would be issues, but they're big plants I'm not worried about. Neither am I really worried about someone using this kind of exploit in the pumps or the pipeline controls at the Valero refinery just outside the Houston Shipping Channel. Where I'm really worried about this are on all of the smaller manufacturing facilities, a lot of agricultural facilities. Think about all the people who have now begun networking irrigation schemes. Networking the pieces that go into our food supply. These are people who have just come into the computer age in the last decade to 15 years. They've come in a huge way, but not with the level of sophistication that, say, the telecom folks have. Those people I worry about a great deal, not only in North America, but in some of the less developed nations, especially the Southern Hemisphere. I have a feeling that there are going to be people who end up losing their lives over this, and they never, till their last breath, fully understand why.
Now, Cheebert, I love what Curtis is talking about when he's talking about how, you know, these smaller systems are going to get jumped into. We've got some people in the chat room who are saying, wait a minute, what are you talking about jumping air gaps? Well, we saw that already, right? We saw that with the Stuxnet virus, which could transmit over a network-connected computer, could then infect a USB drive and then be transferred to another system. So when we're talking about these SCADA devices and separating them from publicly accessible networks, again, because of advanced persistent threats like Stuxnet and like things that one of our friends, Raphael Mudge, comes up with to show how these systems can be penetrated, we can no longer count on the air gap. I'd say the same lessons also apply to Windows XP. One of the things I've been hearing from people is, well, Windows XP will work just fine as long as you don't have it connected to the internet. But again, we can't count on that, right? I mean, that is no longer a defense. You can no longer say, well, I'm not connected to you, so therefore I don't have to worry about viruses. I don't have to worry about worms. I don't have to worry about exploits.
Oh, yeah. God, I can't tell you how many times I've had to clean off my video wall machine because some idiot brought an infected USB stick in. It's a really big problem. There's actually a device from On Labs that I picked up at the last CES that I'm tinkering with. I'm not sure I'm ready to completely trust it yet, but it's basically a puck that you plug into your machine and then you plug the USB into that, and that is your gateway. it's actually an embedded computer that just does malware scanning so that, you know, you have a little bit more safety. But it does kind of bother me. I'm spending an awful lot of money on trying to protect myself from idiots. Maybe education might be cheaper.
Okay, I got that. Yeah, spend money on education, not on idiots. Maybe that's the show title. One last question, because we are really running out of time here. As we talk about the Internet of Things, we talk about all devices being connected to the Internet at all times, being accessible by everything. One of the advantages is the massive amount of data that we could gather. But the obvious disadvantage is now we're connecting to the Internet devices that were really never designed to be on the Internet 24/7. We've got Windows 95 boxes. We've got Windows XP boxes. We've got these CentOS 3000 boxes. We've got SCADA devices scattered across the world, all of which are going to become Internet data points and potential Internet infection points. So my question, and this is an open question to the both of you, as we reach into the Internet of Things and as we look at the potential for that sort of data gathering, do you see anyone hitting the brakes and saying, well, maybe this shouldn't be connected, or maybe this shouldn't be enabled for Internet access? Or is this, well, we're going to figure this out as we go?
I can jump in first. Sure. I think we do have some people saying this, but they're coming from interesting places. For example, at Interop, in one of the speeches, we heard questions about medical devices, medical sensors being used in the NFL. One of the groups that's looking at what this could mean is the NFL Players Association, their union. So you do have, in some instances, the union saying maybe we shouldn't be putting sensors that can identify human beings or what they're doing on the internet. In too many cases, though, people are forging ahead with this without fully thinking it through. And I hate to say it because I love the movement, but there are people in the maker movement who are contributing to the problem. Every time you see someone going, hey, look at this cool new thing I did, I took a Commodore VIC-20 and I have put it on the internet. I've got a Commodore 64 that I'm now using as the controller for my advanced process. Well, on the one hand, that's really neat. On the other hand, those are awfully vulnerable devices. And we know from things like DEF CON that they can, in fact, be used as threat vectors for a lot of other machines. We need to be careful. We need to move forward, but do so with just a little bit of thought and care.
Gilbert, last words, last bit of thought and care from you.
Well, it's always going to be a problem. You know, there's, as more and more things get put onto the internet, more and more things are going to be exposed. You know, that it's, you know, cause and effect. My personal opinion is security for anything that's going to be put on the public internet needs to be your first or second thought. It shouldn't be an afterthought like too many devices. One of the things that I'm hoping to be able to do is Ixia Corporation looks like they're going to hopefully fund my participation in the IETF. And what we're looking to try and do in the relatively near future is create standards for security devices. So if you need varying levels, so say like, for instance, you're a utility, you're going to have a level 5 device. An enterprise might need a level 4, but a home might only need level 1. We're going to try and create some standards so that we can test security devices so that maybe there might be a little level of trust. Hopefully that'll happen. I don't know. Will I be successful? Don't know. It's going to be like herding a very large, large collection of cats to try and agree on some standards.
Meow. Gentlemen, that's it. I'm sorry. We have run out of time. In fact, we've run over time. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang podcast, according to 9 out of 10 barking dogs. I want to thank my panelists. Of course, I want to thank Mr. Smith for coming on, the CTO of Live Action, but also my friends, my geeks in arms. First, you, Brian, what should people know about you? You had Minimaker that you did fabulously. You just finished up Interop. Where else can people find the Geek in Paradise?
Well, the School of Earth Science Technology is 25 years old. So for the next week or so, I am going to be nose to the grindstone trying to get things ready. my dean is actually going to be pulling one of our submarines out of the water for the celebration, all along with our ROV and a bunch of other sexy oceanographic toys. So it's going to be a very busy week and a half indeed.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm going to pull my submarine out of the water too. It's not like, don't feel special just because you've got one. Whatever. No, but let's go to someone who I know doesn't have a submarine. Curtis Franklin, my good friend, thank you so much. What's going on at Enterprise Efficiency? What should people be listening to?
Padre, you're right. I've got nothing to compete with a submarine, but I do have a radio show on Thursday, 2 p.m. Eastern time. We'd love to have folks listen in. And I do have something following up from Interop. I had a chance to go visit with the IT department at Shelby American. So I've got a nice interview with the director of IT over at Shelby talking about what they do with computers to make those cars go so darn fast. That'll be on Enterprise Efficiency a bit later this week. Would love it if folks checked in, take a look at that, along with the photos and the video that I've got going with it.
I will say that I was in the knock when Curtis got back from his visit to Shelby, and he was grinning ear to ear. So, yeah, stay tuned for that. Gentlemen, thank you so very much. Again, each and every single week is so much fun just because I've got you next to me on the Skypes. Now, I also want to thank you. That's right, you, the loyal listener, the loyal watcher, the person who comes back each and every single week and downloads our episodes so that they can enjoy all the Enterprise goodness at their own time. Well, let me give you something. I want to give you an easier way to get it, because going to our website each week can be a pain. Instead of doing that, why not get every episode automatically downloaded into your device of choice? Simply go to our show page at twit.tv/twiet, and you'll find all the different ways you can get This Week in Enterprise Tech, download it into your iPhone or your iPad or your laptop, your desktop, your Windows device, your Android device, any way you want it. That's the way we give it. Any way you want it. That's, again, that's a song. I don't know why that keeps coming through my head. Also, I want to thank those people who stopped by our YouTube page at youtube.com/twiet. I know it's a little quiet in there, but we will get it a bit more rowdy in the near future. We're just trying to clear up a few logistical issues. But drop by and watch not just all of our episodes, but also all of the individual segments. If you are looking for a particular review or a particular stuff my IT guy says, it's going to be in there. It's going to be easy for you to access, and it's going to be easy for you to get all learned. Also, did you know that we do this show live? That's right. Every Monday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific time, if you drop by live.twit.tv, you'll be able to see everything. That's the pre-show, the post-show, the bloopers, all the stuff that doesn't go into the finished episode. Why not drop by and say hi to us on the live? And as long as you're watching live, jump into our chat room at irc.twit.tv. You've seen me pull questions from there. That's, again, because they're filled with some of the brightest engineers, some of the funniest trolls, and just some honest-to-goodness geeks. It's part of the experience that is Twit TV. Now, Jason, this has been a weird week. There's been a lot of Android news. I only wish that Twit TV had a show that talked about Android stuff. Because, you know, I could really use that.
Oh, there is. It's called All That Android, and it's about all those things that are Android related. That's why we called it that. And it's at twit.tv/AAA. The three A's stand for all, about, and then Android.
And you're going to have a crazy show this week, right? Because, I mean, it's been Rumorsville for Android.
Yeah, it's been kind of crazy between Android TV. And, I mean, there's a lot of rumors, but there's also regular news. Tomorrow's going to be a lot of fun. So 5 p.m. Pacific on Tuesdays at live.twit.tv if you want to catch it live. We have a fantastic chat room as well. I'm sure there's a lot of – I know that there's a lot of crossover because I recognize a lot of the same names. It's a great community. It's a great time. All About Android. Check it out.
Gentlemen, one of the hardest working people in the podcasting world – Mr. Jason Howell. Finally, I want to thank not just him, not just that guy, but everyone at the Brick House who makes this show possible, to Lisa, to Leo, to Carson, my super producer, for every single engineer who makes our bits go. Thanks to them, we have Twiet. And I can say, if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep Twiet.